I'm grateful. So my plan today is to talk about something that I find really fun, which is self-contradiction. No, never mind. I don't really find that. And I wanted to start off, though, with a demo from last time about sorting. So I'm going to show you this. This is going to be on the next homework, so it would be a good idea if you kind of got an idea of how I ran it. You'll run it as well. So it's runtime.py. It'll be included with the homework. And so here's what we've got. So as you may recall, last time we talked about several different ways of sorting lists of numbers or strings or whatever. I focused mostly on selection sort and quick sort, but those are only two of a very large list of possible ways of sorting. So John wrote this program to help us try to visualize how these sorting algorithms differ in terms of their performance. And we have a couple different ways of measuring performance and a couple different sorting algorithms. So here are the sorting algorithms we've got. Selection sort, which was the one from the lecture. Does anybody remember how that one goes? We have an unsorted list. The first thing we do is we run through and we find the smallest. We take it out, add it to our now growing sorted list, and we repeat this until all the items are exhausted. It's an n squared algorithm because it takes, if the list has n items in it, then it takes about n to figure out which one is the smallest. And then we have to keep doing that n times. So n times n is n squared. Insertion sort is a different algorithm that takes a very different perspective, not a very different perspective, it's kind of a complementary perspective. What it does is it starts off, it just takes the first card and says, hey, we've got a sorted list of one card. Then it takes the second card and says, okay, where do I have to put that card into this sorted list so that it is sorted? And take the third card and stick it in where it goes, and the fourth card, stick it in where it goes, until you've actually put all the cards into their right places. This is also n squared, because the time that it takes to figure out where that card actually goes and to move the other cards out of the way so that it gets in place is n, in the worst case, and you have to do that for n of the cards. So this ends up being n squared. Bubble sort is really cute. We'll actually demonstrate this one. When I talk about parallel algorithms, we'll actually get up and we'll have you guys like bubble sort yourselves. But basically involves taking two adjacent elements, and if they're out of order, swap them. And you just keep doing that, and elements bubble around, and then they eventually sort themselves out. Merge sort, we'll demonstrate that one as well. Heap sort, heap sort is probably my second favorite sort after quick sort. Quick sort is pretty awesome. And the quick sort is the one I talked about, where you grab, pick a random one, and you sort all the cards as to whether they're smaller or bigger than that, and then recurse on the two halves to sort. Now, so here's what we're going to measure now. If we're going to sort a list of this size, in this case 10 elements, how many comparisons does it do? How many times does it say, is this one bigger than this one? We're just going to count. John's program is going to count how many times that happens in doing the sort. How many times do you have to copy an element from one place to another? No.
Yes.
Is that right? Is that like a swap? Yes. I guess merge sort is not really swap. So yeah. All right. So copy. So how many times do you have to take an element, make a copy of it someplace else in the list, which you have to do if you're doing swaps. And how much space does it end up using up? How much memory does it take to do it? Some algorithms like bubble sort do everything completely in place. Other algorithms like merge sort, they actually use copies of the list and they merge copies of the list. So they all end up being a little bit different. And then what are we sorting? Are we sorting a completely random list? Are we sorting a list that's already sorted? Are we sorting a list that's actually reverse sorted? And these algorithms all act very differently under these different conditions. So let's just try this out. We'll try sorting a random list first. And now what we're looking at is, let's see, these bar graphs. The red bar on the bar graph says how many comparisons it took. And they're all similar, though selection sort is, it looks like the worst in this case. Who's the best? Maybe merge sort? Use the fewest comparisons? All right, what about copies? Well, quicksort did actually a lot of copies. Quicksort, in spite of being such a great algorithm, seems pretty heavy in terms of how many copies it ended up doing. And merge sort used a ton of space. Everybody else used about the same small amount of space. All right, but that was a list of 10. The cool thing about these sorting algorithms is they can apply to very, very big lists. But before we get to very, very big lists, let's try 100. All right, what have we got here? So let's look at the red bars. That's how many comparisons it ended up doing, which is kind of a measure of how long it takes, because most of the work here is in Well, anyway, you have to do a comparison before you can do anything else. So you can see selection sort is actually really bad. I mean, it's doing tons and tons of comparisons compared to merge sort, which actually looks incredibly good compared to selection sort. These differences get bigger and bigger as you're dealing with bigger and bigger lists. Because what's happening, if we take a list of 1,000, is that too big?
Maybe only have selection sort checked.
All right, we'll just run selection sort, but then we can't compare it.
Well, and then one of the shorter searches.
All right.
By doing the checkboxes, you can tell it to only run some of the algorithms. You can see that what's happening here is, with a list of 1,000, what is selection sort doing, right? Remember, it's going through that whole list of 1,000 to find the smallest, then it puts it aside, and then it does it all again, 999 more times. And even fast computers, that starts to add up after a while. So you can see what's happening here. Selection sort is taking up the most, well, the comparisons, it's hard to compare, right? If that's the number of comparisons that selection sort takes, then quicksort is basically doing, you can't even see it on the plot, apparently. It's a tiny little line. So it's all the time that you just saw here was just the time of selection sort doing its thing. Let's take selection sort out of the list. Let's do these three. These are all n log n sorts. All the first three are all order n squared sorts. So of these three, well, so you see how fast it did 1,000 elements? Three times. It sorted three lists of 1,000 quite quickly. Go to 10,000. Should take maybe 10 times as long. All right, anyway, so I'm going to have a homework problem where I ask you to sort, you know, some particular length, either ordered or reversed, and report on what you find. Which algorithms are good with the sorted list, which ones are good with the reversed list, like that.
Homework number two isn't on the website.
Homework number two isn't on the website.
Then it's a question. It is?
Yeah, sure.
It is? Wasn't there
It disappeared and it came back, or as far as you know, it's always been there?
Well, like the number two, she said didn't show up.
Yeah.
And then on mine, it did.
Oh, okay. I can send you a direct link if you lost it. All right, so any questions about this? This will be something to just kind of play with and see how things are different. Yeah?
So the one with the least amount of comparisons is the best one?
Generally, when people are comparing sorting algorithms, theoretically, they're trying to minimize the number of comparisons. Yeah.
So what is the other stuff? Is it really that relevant?
It is a bit. So if you're doing, say you're sorting really big strings, let's just say you're sorting, well, they're not that big, but it's like the names of everybody at Rutgers. So there's thousands of people, each name is something fairly long. Each time you have to copy it, there's a fair amount of shuffling of bytes around. And so you really like your copies to be pretty small too, if you can get away with it. And it just kind of shows that there is a little bit of a trade-off. An algorithm like quicksort, which doesn't really take much in the way of comparisons, well, in this case, it actually doesn't take up much in the way of space. Quicksort is taking, or merge sort is taking fewer comparisons, but more space. So what you really like is an algorithm that doesn't do much on any of these.
Okay.
But if we don't have anything like that, there's always a bit of a trade-off. Great, okay. All right, so that's, we'll return to that when you guys play with it yourselves. In the meantime, I'll just ask a couple questions, but not like that. Excuse me for a second while I change the questions. So, clicker's out. So last time I talked about sorting, and I sang a little song about it. Played you a recording of me singing a little song. I mentioned it to some of the, a friend of mine who said, are you kidding? People this age, they wouldn't even know what song that was. But I don't think that's true. Or maybe it is, but I wanted to find out. So first question is,
what's the original song that from which I got the tune? Just a couple more seconds. 3, 2, 1. Okay, stopping now. Okay, all right, so I thought it was a famouser song than maybe it was.
I wouldn't have known if you hadn't told me.
Really? No, man. You never heard the song?
I'd heard the song. I didn't know what it was called.
Oh, okay. Well, so the better question is, in my song it was, you got to know when to swap them, know when to stop them. What is it in the real song?
No one to hold, no one to hold.
All right, yeah, all right, good. Do people know that? Did everybody know that? No, never heard the song before? No, all right. I don't know if that makes it more funny or less funny, probably a bit less funny. But nevertheless, there's an actual song and it's called The Gambler. Not The Dealer, though The Dealer fits pretty well too, doesn't it? That's what I thought. All right, moving on. All right, so here's another question. This question,
so we're sorting a list of numbers, and we've talked about several different sorting algorithms. What's the same and what's different about the different sorting algorithms? So if we give two different sorting algorithms the same list, and each of them has no duplicate values, just to make it kind of simpler, do they carry out exactly the same steps? Do they carry out different steps but take the same amount of time to get the work done? Do they take different amounts of time but produce the same order when at the end of the day they get the same answer? They produce different answers, but they are solving the same problem. Or are they actually solving different problems?
So when we call them sorting algorithms, how is it that, what is it that's the same, what is it that's different? Not everybody's clicked through yet. Finish this up. 3, 2, 1. I could have sworn there was one more. All right, I'm stopping. All right, so what does it mean for an algorithm to be a sorting algorithm? Do they carry out the same steps?
Well, no. I mean, imagine what would happen if I gave out a stack of cards to everybody and I just told you to just sort your cards. Would you do all the same exact sequence of operations? No, you would do whatever it is you were going to do. So you might carry out different steps. Would you take the same amount of time? No, not necessarily. You could do this in a way that's really slow. In fact, I just demonstrated with John's program that these different sorting algorithms can take very different amounts of time to get the job done. So they can take different amounts of time. Do they have to produce the same order? Well, yeah, that's what it means to sort something. Right? If it kind of could make up its own, make its own decision about what order to put things in, that would really solve the problem. So producing different sorting orders, you can't solve the same problem. So D doesn't really make sense. And if they were solving different problems, we wouldn't call them all sorting algorithms.
So what I was looking for here was C. So when can we have different orders?
So interestingly, nobody was interested in A, B, or E. Everyone went with C and D. It was pretty evenly split. So how can we justify D? In what sense is this a reasonable answer? Anybody want to stick up for your D? There should be nine if you're willing to do so. Yeah, what do you think?
Well, I thought that
So sock sorting is not sorting in the sense that it's really sock pairing, right? It's really about putting the socks together in pairs. We get the same pairs no matter how we do it, but you're right, we can produce the pairs in very different orders. But a sorting algorithm is actually sorting a list in increasing order. That's what it means to sort something, or decreasing order. You don't have that, so the sock sorting isn't really that kind of sorting algorithm. The graph in which it could be.
Remember on the board we wrote like the 2, we go to 3, we see we got like the 2 they were doing, I thought. It's probably sorting the numbers.
When it was walking through a graph, like the stuff that John showed with the. Sure, but that again, that's not sorting. That was graph search. So graph search, yes, you can end up going a very different path and still get to the goal. But a sorting algorithm, so this is a good opportunity to say what a sorting algorithm is. So a sorting algorithm is an algorithm that takes a list and some notion of what it means to be bigger or smaller, and runs for a while and then produces the sorted list from, say, smallest to biggest. If you've used Excel has something where it will sort a list for you, right? You can select a column of numbers and you can say sort, and then it puts them in order. We discovered this when my son was in third grade and had to sort his spelling lists, which we discovered it's a lot easier if you just have the computer do it. Probably defeated the purpose. Nevertheless, that's what sorting is. Sorting is putting it in order from small to big. Okay?
Cool. Alrighty. Alright, so selection sort is one of the algorithms that I talked about a lot last time. How does it sort a list? It repeatedly goes into the list and takes out one of the elements and puts it aside. Which element is it that it's grabbing? Is it the smallest, the median, the average, the first one that's not in order, or does it pick a random item from anywhere in the list? Alright, 3, 2, 1, stopping now. Oh good, alright. So here's selection sort, once again. We have a bunch of numbers that we want to sort. First thing we do is we find the smallest one, and we put it in our sorted list. Then, from what's left, we find the smallest one, put it in our sorted list, writing with my left hand. Then we find the one that's smallest from what's left, put it in the sorted list. Then we find what's left, smallest what's left, put in our sorted list. Find the smallest of what's left, put in the sorted list. Find the smallest of what's left, put in the sorted list. And find the last one, put in the sorted list. And you'll notice that lists tend to get sloppier when they're sorted. I'm not sure why that is. Is that a question?
What was the answer you said?
The one that almost everybody said. The smallest. It's just repeatedly taking the smallest of what's left. Quicksort did something with a random card that it wanted to be the median. Alright, how does the number of card flips of selection sort grow with the number of cards n? So we have these n cards. How many times, when I was showing you doing it with the cards, I had to flip the cards over. How does the number of flips grow as a function of the number of cards that we're trying to sort? Mm-hmm.
the little lights work? Is it? Has anybody ever seen the little vote status thing be red?
Yeah.
No, it's always green. Before I turn things on.
Yeah.
So if I did it now, no, it's red.
No, but you did it when you stopped.
Yeah. Speaking of which, maybe I should stop. A couple more seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So, all right, so you're saying if I did it now, it's unhappy, okay. Right. Is that the only time? If you vote really fast, that doesn't change anything? All right.
So this must be listening for this. Interesting. All right, so what do we get with this? Good, okay. finding the smallest
card in the list grows linearly with the size of the list. But we do this repeatedly when we do selection sort. We do it about n times. So we're talking about something that's quadratic. N log n is what we get with quicksort. So quicksort is actually considerably faster, and the bound that we have on it is n log n in the average case.
Very good. How does quicksort pick an item close to the middle to use as a pivot?
Does it choose something at random? Does it first sort the list so it can see where the median is? It chooses one in the middle of the unsorted list. It actually computes the median directly and then uses it. Or does it take average all the numbers and assume that the average is going to be close to the median? Chosen in quicksort is it just picks a random one for anywhere in the list, and then tries to find out which ones are smaller than it, which ones are bigger than it. If it first sorted the list, that would kind of be a not good use of its time, because the only reason it's trying to pick a pivot is to sort the list. So if it sorted the list first, it wouldn't have to do anything. By choosing one in the unsorted list, I mean, who cares where it is in the unsorted list? Computing the median, that would be really helpful, and there's an algorithm that will do that, but it actually doesn't need to do that. It can actually just choose one at random. Averaging could be a useful thing, but the list could be very skewed. So, any questions about that? So this is the essence of quicksort: is it's trying to sort a list of numbers or a list of whatever. Trying to sort a list, it chooses anything at random and then separates all the items to see whether they're bigger or smaller than that item that was picked. Then, once you know which all these cards are on this side, all these cards are on this side, you can just focus on sorting those, and you know that they're where they belong in the final order. They're not going to intermingle with the ones that they've already been separated from. And that's how it makes steady progress. Okay, any clarification, questions, comments?
All right, so I was going to ask a question about the chapter, but I think I'm just going to dive into the lecture. All right, so here we go.
So I like this topic because it's really mind-bending. And it's not all that useful in the sense of it doesn't tell you how to write better programs, doesn't tell you how to do new startups, it doesn't really tell you anything, but it's just really fun to think about. So here we go. Let me just start off, get you in the right mood. My only piece of advice today is don't listen to anything I say today, it will hurt your head. And that, of course, includes this. So here's why that was funny, and that's why you didn't laugh, I guess. This is funny because if you don't listen to what I say,
what I told you to do was not listen to what I say, then you'd be listening to what I said. But if you listen to what I said, then it would tell you not to listen to what I said.
Or they could choose to listen and ignore your instruction.
That's true. But anyway, the essence of a lot of the stuff that we're going to talk about today is if you believe it, then it has to cause you to not believe it. And of course, not believing it would cause you to believe it, and so it's self-contradictory. So this is self-contradictory, but it's also sort of true, because don't think too hard about what I'm going to talk about. It will, in fact, hurt your head. All right, so that's the topic for today. Self-reference and self-contradiction. Interesting things happen when something can refer to itself, and it can assert of itself that it has properties that negate its own existence. Which seems very philosophical, and in fact, people have done some very philosophical thinking in this topic, but it all grounds out in some interesting computer science. So just to kind of you've thought about these sorts of things before. Everybody's seen oxymorons. Oxymorons are these kinds of phrases that kind of conflict with themselves, that the meaning of the phrase, the parts of the phrase, contradict one another. So you have things like government organization. This is a top 10 list. I didn't make these up. Government organization, because you think government's very disorganized. The fact that there's an organization, that kind of contradicts it. What else we got? Alone together. We could be alone together. You can't, actually, technically. Personal computer. Computers are very impersonal. The idea of a personal computer is somewhat contradictory. Silent Scream is the name of a video. Self-contradictory. The Living Dead. Well, no, if they're dead, they're not living. Same difference. Taped live. Plastic glasses. Tight slacks. Right? Slacks means loose. Peace Force. Pretty ugly. Headbutt. Thanks, John. I thought it was funny, too. Working vacation. Tax return, because taxing is taking away and returning is giving back. Virtual reality. Is it real or is it not real? Dodge Ram. That's the name of a truck, right? But to dodge something is to get out of the way, and to ram is to run into it. So that would be work party. Jumbo shrimp. This is now, we're almost a healthy tan. And number one, Microsoft Works, which I totally would have put at the top of this list, but this was not my list anyway. All right, so oxymorons are very funny. I can tell from the reaction that everybody gave. Okay, maybe not so funny. They seem incongruous, but really, they all actually make sense. I mean, Dodge Ram is not actually Dodge and Ram. It's actually Dodge is the name of the company. I don't know why. It's probably somebody's name or place. And Ram after the animal. So it really isn't contradicting itself. Jumbo shrimp just means big for a shrimp, right? It doesn't mean that it's big and small at the same time. So there's contradiction here, but it's not really very deep. But there's some examples that are actually much more deep. So here, this is a list that I made. Some of these people have actually said. I always say, silence is golden. Well, then shut up. We're not effing bitter. This company in my department said this once. Like, you guys seem bitter. We're not effing bitter. I think you are. I remain silent. No. I'm not in denial. Eschew obfuscation, right? This means avoid saying things that are more complicated than they need to be. But it's saying that in a way that actually is more complicated than it needs to be. When you least expect it. Well, then you'd be expecting it. No, then you can't expect it. I'm sorry, I don't speak English. I'm not talking to anyone. I can't talk right now. I'm sorry, but I just don't care. Well, then why are you sorry? Leave me be, I'm asleep. Well, probably not if you just answered. I'm speechless. I prefer not to have an opinion. All right, these are some that I like. These are some quotes from famous, or some not so famous, comedians. You know what I hate most? Rhetorical questions. They all laughed when I said I was going to be a comedian. Well, they're not laughing now. Seriously, you're not laughing now. Why are you not laughing now? That was funny. Come on, help me out here. Can I have Bobby to put these lists together? All right, so why is this funny? It's never funny if you have to explain why it's funny. Why is this funny? This is funny because they all laughed when, basically they're saying they all laughed when I was saying I was going to be a comedian because it wasn't funny enough to do it. Well, they're not laughing now. In other words, see, I'm a great comedian. Then there's another level that's funny here because almost everyone, except for you people, when reading this, you laugh. So they're not laughing now, but actually you are laughing. All right, let me see. Is there any other good ones here? You're making me want to skip them. I happen to like this one. Last month I flew $5,000 on a reincarnation seminar. I figured, hey, you only live once. Stephen Wright uses a lot of this stuff in his humor. Things like, I almost had a psychic girlfriend, but she left me before we met. Sort of, you know, it contradicts itself. It can't be that that is how it... I'd kill for a Nobel Peace Prize. You probably wouldn't get it if you had to kill for it. I was trying to daydream, but my mind kept wandering.
All right. Have anything better? You guys are tough.
For the quote from Pirates of the Caribbean, me, I'm dishonest, and a dishonest man you can always trust to be dishonest. Honestly, it's the honest ones you want to look out for. And then this is probably my favorite. From The Life of Brian, Monty Python. We are a big crowd. They all shout out, we are all individuals. And then one lone guy off to the side says, I'm not.
Okay. Maybe you like visual ones better. Here's some visual ones I found on the web.
This is a real place in Texas whose name is No Name. Does it have a name? Does it not have a name? Well, that's where you exit to get to No Name, Texas. Anybody know who that is? It's Clint Eastwood, back in his younger days.
The man with no name?
It's the man with no name. He's the man with no name. That's his name. This space intentionally left blank, which of course isn't because of that. There's a restaurant called No Name. I happen to like this one, The Neverending Story 2. Oh, come on! I mean, if it was a never-ending story, you'd never get to 2. That's just silly. Keep door closed at all times. It's not much of a door then, is it? That would be called a wall. This is a famous painting by Manny Magritte that says in French, this is not a pipe. And this I found when I was looking around. This is a good computer joke. Good. These symbols, this slash star and star slash, are in the C programming language how you mark a comment. If you're typing a program and you want the computer to just ignore it, so just that it's there so other people can read it, you put a comment, this comment says no comment, but of course it is a comment, and the comment is no comment.
Do you have a comment? No comment. All right, the Escher famous drawing hands. We've got one hand that's drawing the other hand, which is erasing the first hand. Probably should have drawn it in the first place. All right, so here's an oxymoron, serious fun. So there's a weird idea here, even though it's fun as a source of humor and cleverness, but you shouldn't be able to say something that if you interpret it properly results in another statement that contradicts the original statement. You shouldn't be able to say something that essentially asserts that it doesn't exist, because then it couldn't have existed. Because then you get these kind of go back in time and kill your own grandfather sorts of things, right? Like, I know what I'll do, I'll invent a time machine, I'll go back and I'll kill my grandfather. Okay, but then if your grandfather's dead, then you never got born, then you never created the time machine, so you couldn't have gone back to kill your grandfather, so your grandfather's alive, so you were born, so you went back in time. Yeah, right? So naughty, crazy things happen if you allow this. And there's some deep mathematical insights that come from applying this idea. So I want to mention a couple of these. Probably not in enough detail for you to really wrap your heads around them, but I just want to expose you to these in case you haven't heard them before, and if you get a chance to think about them more later. Here's a famous one. Russell's paradox is, there's this town, and in this town there's a barber. His job is to shave every man in town who does not shave himself. So who shaves the barber? If the barber shaves himself, then the barber doesn't shave him. So he doesn't shave himself, because he shaves only those who don't shave themselves. So he can't shave himself. So it must be that he doesn't shave himself. Well, the barber shaves everyone who doesn't shave himself, so then he actually does shave himself. Okay, so this is weird. So what's wrong here? First of all, no one wants to live in town. But that's not really the punchline here. The punchline is here, something's gone wrong. There are some very clever ways of getting around this. Has anybody heard any of the ways to break this paradox? One is, well, what if the barber's a woman? Right? Then everything's fine, right? Because he only shaves every man in town who does not shave himself. So she neither shaves her himself or not. So anyway, it's fine if it's a woman barber. That's one clever trick. Anybody know any others? Yeah, one.
Could you interpret who does not shave himself as everyone who doesn't shave the barber?
Aha! That would really screw it up too. There's a barber. His job is to shave every man in town who does not shave the barber. but then you still have the same paradox, right? So does he shave himself? Does he shave the barber? If he doesn't shave the barber, then he has to shave the barber.
Maybe he doesn't get paid for shaving himself, so it's not his job.
So it's not part of his job. All right. Well, so there's semantic ways of playing games with this and making the puzzle go away. But really, this was created for a very important reason. This was created by a guy named Stuart Russell, who is a mathematician. And the whole point of this example was to show that if you're allowed to create sets, define sets any way you want, in any kind of language you want, then you can make these bizarre statements that just can't be, they can't exist. You can't make that statement. You shouldn't be allowed to make that statement. And so there was the idea of naive set theory that says you can define sets any way you want has this bad hole in it. So if you have an unscripted self-reference, you can create a possible situation. He used this as a reason for saying, you know what, we're not going to allow sets to be created that way. We're going to make a special restrained language. And he proved that as long as you make sets using that language, they won't have any of these contradictory paradoxical problems.
So that was actually a very clever use of that kind of riddle.
Gödel's theorem is also very, very interesting. I don't know if people have seen this. There's a book called Gödel, Escher, Bach by Douglas Hofstetter that won all sorts of awards. It's a fun read, and probably if you think you ever want to read it, read it while you're in college. It's the only time that it's great. After college, it starts to get old. But in college, it's actually brilliantly clever. I have found this because I have tried reading it in both before and after, during and after college. But Gödel is the Gödel of Gödel, Escher, Bach. It's this guy who's a mathematician. Here he is hanging out in New Jersey with Einstein. They were both in Princeton together. Here's what he did. He created the following statement. This statement cannot be proven using mathematics. All right? And what he showed is that any system of mathematics that you create that's powerful enough to include things like the integers, like the whole notion that there's numbers and they go on forever, as soon as you have that, it's powerful enough to create self-referential statements like this. So our regular system of mathematics, you can say, just using mathematical symbols, this statement itself, cannot be proven. All right, so given that you can say that, what does that lead to? Well, it turns out that this statement, well, it's either true or false. Just the fact that we can say it doesn't make it true. So we can say it. If it's false, in other words, this statement can be proven, then we can actually prove something that's wrong, right? You can prove this statement. This statement says that it itself cannot be proven. And so if you can actually prove it, you've proven something that's wrong, like proving that 2 equals 3. Then all of mathematics breaks down. This is called inconsistency. We think that mathematics is not inconsistent. If it were inconsistent, then everything we know is basically garbage, because you could prove anything. And things that are true, things that aren't true, it doesn't matter anymore. All right. So if this statement is false, then all mathematics breaks down. The other possibility, though, is it's true. If it's true, that means here's a statement that's true that you can't prove. All right? And that means that mathematics is incomplete. It means there are things that you can say in math that are true, but you can never prove that they're true. This freaked a lot of people out. Actually, it continues to freak some people out. But at the time, this was huge. Basically, he showed that either mathematics is broken or has holes in it. There's nothing else. There's no way that you can have anything else. It can't be just perfect all the way through. Either it's got holes or it contradicts itself. Stuart Russell's the AI guy. What am I thinking of? Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell, who did the Russell's paradox that I had up there a moment ago, one of the things he wanted to do in his life is basically make a book that proved everything there was to prove in mathematics. And what Gödel did is he came by and said, You can't. You can't prove everything that's true. There are things that are true that you can't prove. That's whack. That's just very strange. It's just crazy. But there it is. There's another. Let's. How are we doing on time here? Let's see. The battery. 4:03. All right. So I get a lot of pushback when I tell this story, but I'll do the best that I can with it. There's a thing called Cantor's diagonalization proof that uses some of these same ideas. So what Cantor's diagonalization argument lets us do is compare two particular infinities. So how many fractions are there? You know, number divided by number. There's an infinite number of them, right? You got a half, you got a third, you got a quarter, you got a tenth. We can stay at this, you know, as long as we care to stay at it. There's no bound to the number of fractions. How about the number of decimals? There's 0.03, there's 0.7779, there's 0.333333, repeating infinitely. There's an infinite number of decimals. Are they the same size infinity? Okay, let me make sure that I understand the question. What does it mean to say that one infinity is bigger than the other? What does it mean to say that one infinity is the same size as another? Turns out there's lots of different ways you could define it. But the way that that's most generally accepted is we'll say that two sets are the same size if they can be put into one-to-one correspondence with one another. So in particular, I know that the number of feet I have and the number of shoes I have are the same. I could count them, but even without counting, I know that each shoe has a foot and each foot has a shoe, and therefore, I don't know, even if I don't know what the number is, I know that the numbers are the same. Okay, you with me on that? So this is the notion of, it's one-to-one correspondence.
How else can I demonstrate that?
Your problem.
All integers greater than one and all integers greater than two.
Right, so that's where it starts to get weird. So that's what we'll do next. But for finite sets, basically the two sets are the same size is if we can list out all the elements in set A, and we can list out all the elements in set B, and we can match them up so that each one in A has exactly one in B, each one in B has exactly one in A, therefore they're the same size. You don't have to count them. In fact, one way of defining what counting is making one-to-one correspondence between the thing you're counting and a set of numbers. Right, so how do I know there's five fingers? Because if you look at the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you can assign each of those numbers to one of my fingers, each of my fingers to one of those numbers. They're the same size. All right, so if we buy that, because it makes a lot more sense in the case where things are finite, if we use that same idea to think about infinite size sets, things get a little bit hard to wrap your head around. So, but we'll do it anyway. So we'll use John's example. So we have all the numbers, say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. This is an infinite set. But, you know, you can tell me whether certain things are in the set or not. Like, is 11 in this set? Assuming what I mean by dot, dot, dot here is the rest of them. Right? So 11 is in this set, right? Is 0 in this set? No, we started at 1, and we started going forward from there. Right? So this is a set of infinite size, but we know what's in the set and what's not. All right, here's another set. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on. So we don't mix things up. So we'll call this set A, we'll call this set B. Now, naively, intuitively, you'd think, well, everything in set B, all the elements of set B are in set A, right? This is 2 to infinity, and this is 1 to infinity, so we've got 2 to infinity inside of it. So you'd think that A is bigger, right? But not the way we're defining it. The way we're defining it is if they're the same size as if we can put them in one-to-one correspondence. Which we can do here, right? We'll match this one with this two with this three with this four with this five. Everybody's got a partner. So up here, the number 153, who's the partner for
153?
154. All right, what about in this list? If we get out to, say, I don't know, 739, that needs a partner too. Who's 739's partner in list A? Somebody else? Anybody else?
738.
Okay. So, you give me anything in list B, I can tell you who it goes with in list A. You give me anything in list A, I'll tell you who it goes with in list B. They're in one-to-one correspondence. These sets are the same size. They're infinitely large, but they're the same size. All right? Go ahead.
This is what I'm having trouble with.
All right.
They have a size that they go over. Because the size is like you stop somewhere and then you compare it.
Yeah. So the size is infinite, but... Yeah, I agree. So this is something we're just defining. You can't just use the standard notion of what it means to be able to enumerate and say, this is the number of elements in it. Here, the size, we just say two things are the same size if we can match them up. It's hard to define infinite set sizes without that. Yeah?
Right, so are two things that are infinite always the same size?
That's a great question. That is exactly the question that we're going to get to. But let's look at one other example first. This one, they seem like intuitively they were almost the same size to start. But what if we do this instead? What if we say list A, what if A were the evens and B were the odds? Those the same size? Intuitively, those are definitely the same size. But what if A is all the counting numbers, and B is just the evens? So we're just going to skip every other one here. Are these the same size? Well, in some sense, this feels like it's half the size of that, right? But it's not, because we can put them in one-to-one correspondence. We can line them up. In fact, any infinite size set that you can list, you can make a long list that follows some particular rule, can be matched up with any other one that you could lay out in the list, because you'll just match up the first ones, and match up the second ones, and match up the third ones. And so this infinity, I forget what the name of it is. I guess the count is countable?
Countable
infinity. Anything you can make lists of is going to work this way. It's going to be, they're all going to be the same size. All right. Can you always do that? Well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do it's called a proof by contradiction. Let's assume that we can make a list of all decimal numbers, all point blah, 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 numbers. Okay? And what we're going to show is that we can't list them all. You're always going to leave something off the list, and therefore it's a bigger set than a set of all fractions. All right, so that's where we're going to go. You may reject this. A lot of people seem to reject this. First, let me kind of argue that you can actually list all the fractions. You really can make a list of all the fractions so that every fraction is included. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to start with all the fractions where the numerator and denominator add up to 1. So that's 0 over 1. Then we'll do all the ones where the numerator plus the denominator add up to 2. So 0 over 2, 1 over 1. Then we're going to list all the ones where the numerator and the denominator add up to 3, so we get 0 over 3, 1 over 2. Did I miss one in the list? And 2 over 1 should be there. You can list them, I didn't do it correctly, but there's 2 over 1 hiding in there. All right, then all the ones where all the elements add up to 4. I guess I'm only listing the ones that are smaller than 1, is that right? Yeah, okay, all right, no bug here. These are all the fractions that give you a value between 0 and 1. And we could just keep listing them out. Give me any fraction that's between 0 and 1, it's going to show up someplace in this list. Okay? So, you know, like 57 over 911. Where's that going to be? Well, eventually we're going to get to the ones where we're listing all the fractions where the numerator plus the denominator add up to 968. And at that point, the 57th one on that sublist is going to be this one. Okay? So every fraction will show up someplace on this list. So therefore, this infinity is the same as the infinity of all the counting numbers, the same as the infinity of all the evens. We're all set. All right, so now let's try the same idea with the decimals. So now, the decimals can be arbitrarily, they can be infinitely long sequences of numbers, right? So the first one on the list, say, is 0.5795391, and it just keeps going on and on and on. Not even with any pattern, it just goes on and on and on. That's the first one on the list. And then our second one on the list might be something else, third one on the list is something else, and so on. We have an infinite list of these fractions. And what I'm going to do is explain that there is a number that's a perfectly good fraction that is not on this list. How can I do that? I don't even know what the list is. But watch, I'll give you a rule for figuring it out. First thing we're going to do is we're going to read down the diagonal. So 0.58980324677, right? There's a decimal. If you just read along the diagonal, there's a decimal number. That one may be on our list. We don't know. So what we're going to do is we're going to add 1 to each of these digits with wraparound. If it was a 9, we'll bring it back to a 0. So we take this number that we created, 0.58980324677, et cetera, and we turn it to 0.6, this becomes a 69091435478, and so on, right? So from that rule, you can create a number, a decimal number. And I'm going to claim that that number can't be on this list. Okay, how do we know that it's not on the list? Well, tell me where it is on the list. Let's say that it's the 9th one on the list. It can't be the 9th one on the list because the 9th digit of the number on your list is different from the 9th digit in this number that I just created for you. Why? Because I took the 9th digit from your number and I added 1 to it. So they don't match. Can't be. So there's a number. There's at least one. There's actually an infinite number of numbers that aren't on this list. But all we needed was 1 to prove that no matter how you list out all the decimals, you can't list them all. And therefore, there's an infinite number of decimals, but it's a bigger infinity than the infinity which is the number of fractions. Anybody want to rebut that, or say that it's cool, or just let it wash over them? Think about it anyway. This is just a freaky, neat fact. And the way that this is done is by a kind of self-contradiction, right? We created something that was different from everything else by just flopping one little piece of it. So we made something that's not on the list by making it, we made the list kind of refer to itself, but not. Maybe that's not a good explanation. The point is that this is a very clever, kind of internally twisted argument. Yes?
How do you know it's not going to be on the list if it's an infinite list?
So my claim is, if it's on the list, it's someplace on the list. And if it's someplace on the list, it has to actually match in every digit. Wait, sorry. Yeah, so the number that I've created, if it's on the list, it's going to have to match in every digit with some element in the list. But the way I created this number was by taking digits from the list, one from each of the numbers on the list, and flipping it, adding one to it, so that it will be specifically different from the first one in the first digit, the second one in the second digit, the third one in the third digit. It will be different from everything on this list.
Well, I thought those numbers don't mean anything. I thought you could just put them together into sets of different numbers and it'll just be a set. It would just be a...
Well, these are decimals, right? These are numbers. This is 0.57953, right? That's a number. It's like a little more than a half.
So now you have to get the number with the number.
So this is, all I'm saying is that if you're going to take all the decimals between 0 and 1 and make a list of them, the list has to be incomplete, even if it's infinitely long. There has to be a number that's between 0 and 1 that's not on the list. Because it's different from everything on the list. I showed you how to create one that's different from everything on the list. Yeah, it takes a little absorbing. I mean, the guy who thought of this is, he's famous because this is really hard to think of. It's very twisted. All right, so, here's the steps again. We take the digits down the diagonal and we add one to them. So you can't make a list of all the decimals. You can make a list of all the fractions. There are more decimals than fractions. All right, so enough of that. Let's get back to computer science for a second. So, I'm going to define a problem for you, and then I'm going to talk about whether or not it's possible to solve that problem. And the argument that I'm going to use is another one of these self-referential negation things. But the problem is actually sort of interesting in and of itself, and it's one it's easy to make exam questions on, so I'm going to ask you exam questions on this. So here's given input 10, each of these programs counts backwards from 10 to 1. We've got three different programs, example 1, example 2, example 3. They each take some input n. And then in response to that, for I in range n, okay, so what this is doing is saying, start at n, make a list of the numbers from n to 0, going backwards by minus 1s, print that element. So that's one that does it. Here's another one. While n is greater than 0, print n, and then subtract 1 from it, make it 1 smaller than it was. Okay, that'll also print 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then when n equals 0, it'll stop. This example, it takes 10 as input. It says, forever, print the number, subtract 1 from it, and then if we ever hit 0, then we break out of the loop. We return, so then it ends. So it's going to go 10, subtract 1, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, it'll print 1. It'll subtract 1 from that, and now n is 0. When n reaches 0, the subroutine stops. Okay? So they all do the same thing from that perspective. So here's the question, ready? For each of these algorithms, is there some n that we could give it? Not 10, obviously, because we know what it does with 10. Is there some other n that we can give it that would cause the program to loop forever? In other words, it'll do something, but it won't it'll never stop. All right. Well, let's think about this. So this one, assuming this range function doesn't go infinitely long, we're going to create some list here. And then for each of the elements in the list, we're going to print them. So I don't think there's any way to make this go on forever. All right, what about this one? Well, n is bigger than 0, it's going to print n and subtract 1 from it. So if n, let's say n starts off as a negative number, well, then it's going to do nothing, because n is not bigger than 0. So it'll just stop without doing anything. If it's equal to 0, it'll stop. If it's anything bigger than 0, it's going to start counting down until... Excuse me, I'm a little congested. Until it gets smaller than 0 or equal to 0, and then it'll stop. So is there any number we can give it where it'll never stop? No, because any number that we give it 1,000 or something like that, it's going to step down 1,000 times, and eventually it'll get smaller than 0, and then it'll stop. So this one will always stop. This one will always stop. What about this one? We give it a number, n, and then it's going to repeat forever, printing that number, subtracting 1 from it, and if that number
once we subtract it from it, if it ever hits zero, it'll stop. But what if it starts out as, say, negative 1? If it starts out as negative 1, it'll print negative 1, then n is going to be 1 smaller, so now it'll be negative 2. Is negative 2 0? No, so it won't, this won't happen. It'll go back, it'll print negative 2, it'll subtract 1 from it, become negative 3. Is that equal to 0? No. It's going to keep doing this loop forever for any number that starts off less than 0. So this one, we can make it run forever. It'll never stop. Well, it'll stop when we, you know, shut down the computer or something like that. But it's not, the program didn't stop. We just stopped tolerating it. All right, is that clear? Is anyone have a question about that? So I'm going to ask variations of this sort of thing by giving n equals, I don't know, n times 2 or n equals n plus 1, and I'll put different conditions in the while loop, and you have to kind of reason through what can I feed into this that'll make it screw up? All right? I'll give more concrete examples later. So what am I asking you to solve? I'm asking you to solve a problem that's known as the halting problem. The halting problem goes like this. First of all, you notice that looping forever is one of the most annoying classes of programming errors. As soon as you start developing programs of any complexity whatsoever, you discover that you can shoot yourself in the foot. You can create a program that will do nothing and not stop doing nothing. Or maybe it'll even do something, like it'll start erasing the disk, and it just refuses to stop until you actually intervene. It's just, they're called infinite loops. Is there another good name for them? Sometimes you'll say the program hung, because it's just like doing something, but nothing visible, and it never stops doing that. It goes catatonic. I mean, it's just really irritating. So wouldn't it be great if we actually could take the program that we wrote and run another program on it that would tell us whether that program is going to have that problem? That would be really useful, because then before you actually run it and see it just hang, another program is going to say, you know, your program, if you give it the input of 7, is going to run forever. So you might want to fix that. So that's what we'd like, a subroutine that we'll call it halt, that takes as input actually a program or a string that defines a program, and returns true if that program halts, no matter what the inputs it takes. And otherwise, it'll say false if the input, if there is some input that makes it loop forever. Okay? This would be a useful thing, I claim. Unfortunately, if we could do that, we could do something bad. We could basically create a barber's paradox. Like who shaves the barber? Well, if the barber shaves the barber, then... So here's the paradox. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to create a new program. So I'm writing in Python, I'm calling it contrary. Like Mary, Mary, quite contrary. This is a program that's annoying in the following sense. First thing it does is it takes as input a program. Now that program might actually be itself. If it is, then if we call the subroutine halt to ask, does this program halt on all inputs? If the answer is yes, then we go into an infinite loop. If the answer is no, then it's going to fall through and return. So this is a program that, when run on itself, will go into an infinite loop if halt says it doesn't go into infinite loops, and otherwise, it stops. Okay, so why is this a problem? Well, what does contrary do if you run it on itself? If halt says the contrary halts on all inputs, it's true. That means contrary halts on all inputs, so it should halt on input as itself as input. So if halt of contrary is true, then it should always halt. It should not go into an infinite loop no matter what. But in this case, that's exactly when contrary loops forever. So it basically asks, do I go into an infinite loop? And if the answer is no, then it says, fine, I'm going into an infinite loop. This is sort of the toddler version of self-reference. So it must be that halt on contrary is false. So contrary loops forever on some input. But in this case, note the contrary run on that program actually halts no matter what, even itself. So it always halts if it's called on something other than contrary. But if it says that that there's some input that it loops forever on, then it's going to halt on all inputs. So if it says, hey, you know, you go into an infinite loop, then it's just going to stop and say, no, I don't. I'm done. Just like that. So something's wrong here. Something's broken. And what was broken, the only assumption that we made, is that you could write a program called halt that can test whether something is going to halt on all inputs.
then we'll always stop. Therefore, can't do it. Perfectly reasonable, fun thing to do, would be really useful, can't be done. If it could be done, then black is white, white is black, up is down, cats and dogs living together. I mean, basically, it can't happen. Things fall apart. So we know that it's impossible to write. Now, we could write a version of this that would work most of the time and would still be very useful, but we can't solve this problem for all inputs. Can't be done. So here's what computer scientists conclude from all this. So Halt's perfectly reasonable, well-defined problem, and no program can solve it. Therefore, it's incomputable. It's an example of a problem that a computer can't solve. Now, again, just like Gödel's theorem, some people are a little freaked out by this. The mathematicians didn't like Gödel's theorem because it said, hey, there's things you can't do, haha. And this is saying to computer scientists, hey, there's programs you can't write. Doesn't matter how smart you are. Doesn't matter how hard you work at it. Doesn't matter how long you take trying to hack it and how clever you are with your inputs. It can't be done. You can't do it. Just gotta live with disappointment. Now, it turns out that there's lots of problems in computer science that turn out to be incomputable. And most of them involve, all of them involve some kind of computation that may take an infinite number of comparisons, and you're never quite sure when to stop it. And that's the only reason that you know that it could go on forever. Otherwise, it'd be really easy to figure out. I actually posed an open problem in my thesis, and I said, you know, I think this might be incomputable. It was a perfectly natural problem. It was one that I actually cared about. And I wasn't trying to be tricky or anything. I just wanted to know the answer. But it seemed hard, and it seemed like it could very well be incomputable. Another student in another university went on and actually proved it. So that's now known to be incomputable. There's lots of problems that have these properties. Hillis in the chapter basically says, oh, this is not interesting at all because they're all basically the halting problem in disguise. This one didn't look like the halting problem at all. This looked like a planning optimization problem. But it turned out you couldn't do it. Not you, anybody. Can't be done. All right, so philosophers like this sort of thing. Because some of them use it as a kind of a wedge. And they say, well, you know, people can look at programs and tell you whether they're going to halt, because we're smart. But programs can't. We proved that already. That's the whole halting problem argument. Therefore, people are smarter, better looking, and they smell better than computers, right? We're just better. We're just better. And that's why computers will never be like us, because we can solve the halting problem and they can't. And this turns out to be just wrong on so many levels. Even if it were true that we could always do what computers couldn't, it doesn't mean that computers can't be smart like us. It doesn't mean that our ability to detect halting problem solutions is what makes us us. So, but that's a kind of hand-wavy argument. Let me give a better argument. Here's a very small program. It looks a lot like the ones that I talked about before. It's called the Kolak's problem. Here's what it does. It takes as input a number x and says, well, x is bigger than 1, we're going to print x, just like we were doing before. If x is even, we're going to divide it in half. So any even x is going to get halved. Otherwise, if it's odd, we're going to multiply it by 3 and add 1. Okay? And then we go back and we do that again. We're going to keep doing this. If it's a power of 2 number, if x starts off as something like 8, then it's going to go 8, 4, 2, 1, and then it'll be less than 1, it'll stop. Oh, no, sorry. What'll do when it's 1? Well, x is greater than 1. Oh, well, as soon as it becomes equal to 1, this will stop. This will only loop as long as x is bigger than 1. So perfectly reasonable question to ask a smart person, mathematician, computer science, any philosopher, you call them smart people, is this going to halt on all inputs? Here's the thing. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. People have actually been staring at this for 25 years, thereabouts. Nobody knows. There's something really wacky about this particular transformation. You take a number, halve it if it's even, if it's odd, triple it and add 1, and just keep doing that. Triple it and add 1 as long as it's odd. You get these sequences that kind of hop around the numbers. And then as far as we know, it always ends up collapsing back down and getting to 1. But we can't. Nobody can prove. No one has been able to prove that that's going to be true of all numbers. As far as we know, there could be some number that when you start doing this to it, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and never stops. Or it could be that you get some number and it goes through some series of transformations and gets back to itself. And then the whole process will keep repeating forever. Nobody knows. So can people solve the halting problem? I'm not so sure. We don't know how to do this. So
I don't see the halting problem as something that distinguishes people from computers. It seems like it's hard for us too. So let's see, where are we on time now? 4:29. All right, so, good.
So I don't have too much more to say about this. I'll just do this as a, as I said, an odd little aside. So for the contrary program that I showed you, one thing that it has to do is it has to know whether it's being called on itself as input. How could programs know what they are? So it turns out that for a lot of these, they talk about the thing called Gödel numbering. That every program needs to sort of know what's in it. And so it needs some degree of self-awareness almost. So how would you do that? So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to create a subroutine called subr that's going to take as input a string, and it's going to produce a new string as output. So you give it some sequence of characters, it's going to do something to them, and then produce them back out. It's essentially going to just copy it, but some special characters are converted, substituted. So here's the rule. Whenever in the string, whenever it sees a 2, it's going to turn it into a quotation mark. Whenever it sees a 3, it's going to actually put the whole string back out. Whenever it sees 4, it's going to put an end of line. Whenever it sees 5, it's going to put a tab. Whenever it sees 6, it's going to put backslash n. Whenever it sees 7, it's going to put backslash t. And whenever it sees 8, it's going to put backslash backslash. All right, so here's the program. Subr takes a string q, and it's going to loop through all the characters in q, and if the character is a 2, if the character is a 2, then it's going to put a quote in. If the character is a 3, 1 plus 1 plus 1, it's going to put the whole string back in. If the character is a 4, 1 plus 1 plus 1, then it's going to put back a new line, and so forth. Okay? So it's going to take a string, it's going to copy the characters, maybe make these slight changes with it. Okay, why? Well, watch this. If we call subr on the following string, def self print 45 print subr 232. If we call it on that string and you run it, what you get back is exactly this. It prints itself out. It's a subroutine that actually prints itself out. Which is weird when you think about it, because how can you do that? How can you print yourself out? Unless you know who you are in some sense. Right? So it prints itself out, here's why it's sort of weird, right? So if I had to repeat, let's say some point in the lecture, I had to say, okay, somebody comes in late. Let me repeat the whole lecture for you, word for word. I'd start back at the beginning, and I'd go forward again until I got to the part where I said, oh, and here's the whole lecture again. At which point, I'd have to start doing the whole lecture again from the beginning, because that's what I started doing at that point in the lecture. And so the lecture would be infinitely long, which I don't think any of us want, frankly. So how do you make it print out itself without repeating the fact that it's repeating itself as part of the string? So that's what the cleverness of this little subr algorithm does. That when it gets to, which one was it, 3. When it gets to the 3, it actually takes the whole string and puts it back in again. So here's a slightly weirder version that actually includes the definition of subr as part of the thing that it prints out. So a program can actually contain its entirety in compressed form inside of itself. So you get kind of sort of Russian doll kind of thing, right? You got a program that is the whole program, but it's inside itself. I told you some of this stuff would hurt your head. Right, so we should be getting something infinitely big, but it's actually not because of the way that we're substituting variables. All right, one other thing I wanted to mention from the chapter that we read for today, which was, I think, chapter 4, he also talked about the Church thesis. What that says is, I want to ask a quicker question. Maybe I should ask a quicker question on it. All right, so how would I do this? No, here's an easier one to ask. Some philosophers take the evidence of the halting problem, the existence of the halting problem, as evidence that people are not computers. And he says the reason probably they're doing this is because it offends people's sensibility to think that, you know, a computer and a person are at all the same, that it's somehow demeaning to us. And what was his response to this? Did he say, oh no, actually computers are much more special than people think? Did he say, no, people really are dirt? Did he say, this shouldn't really bother anybody? Did he say, actually, it bothers me? What he ended up saying was that this is really sort of a non-issue. He doesn't feel at all threatened by the fact that what a computer can do and what he can do are really not fundamentally different. What Church and Turing said is that any way of doing computation all boils down to the same thing. And the way that they do this is by a form of what's called reduction. I've talked about reduction a couple times. I think that's the fundamental idea in computer science is the idea that you can take a big complicated problem of any sort and break it down into simpler pieces, reducing it in the process to something that's simpler that we could solve some other way. So what Church's thesis is, take any way of creating what you might think of as computation. You can always turn it into the kind of computation we've been talking about, the sort of thing that Python can do or that a circuit can do. And in fact, anything that anyone's ever proposed as a model for computation, this has been true. You can always turn anyone into any of the other ones. There seems to be just one way to do computation. No one knows of any other way that's any different. You can throw in DNA computing and you can throw in quantum computing, and the sorts of problems that you can solve are the same. There's only one, as far as we know, the thesis is there's only one kind of computing. Everything reduces to that fundamental model of computing. Which is a sort of interesting, neat idea. And if that's true, then it would be, since we're doing computing, then we would be reducible to the same kind of computations that you do on a computer as well. It doesn't bother me either. I think it does bother some people, and I've certainly gotten pushback. But it is what it is. All right, any questions or comments before we break up? I think I peaked a little early today. We good? Yeah, you want to hear the vault, right? So next time, I will send out mail for what we're going to talk about next time. Have a good Thanksgiving. Thanks a lot for coming by.